In this segment, we're going to talk about women in the gospel. So we're switching a little here from a kind of a general overview and how people lived into looking at certain texts. And these are texts from the New Testament, of course. So the study of women in the gospels is something that has been, as you can imagine, worked on a lot. And what we're going to do is not look at every woman who appears in the Gospels, but we'll focus on a few characters in Luke and in John, and then look just briefly at Mark and Matthew, and then some concluding reflections. So in Luke, of course, the three women who stand out in Luke's Gospel are Mary, Elizabeth, and Anna. And they all happened within the first two chapters of Luke's Gospel, what we call the infancy stories. And as you probably know, there is another set of stories in Matthew, in infancy stories, that really tell the story from the point of view of Joseph, whereas this one at the beginning tells the story from the point of view of Mary. And it is in Luke that you have these lovely references to Mary, who treasures everything, keeping it in her heart. And it's Mary's song of exultation when she meets Elizabeth, and the two children, Jesus and John, in their wombs. John leaps for joy, Elizabeth says. So you have these wonderful stories. And of course, it's in Luke's infancy stories that we have the shepherds coming to the stable and our standard Christmas stories. But I want to focus not on the stories themselves, but on the women. And each of them, in a way, functions as a prophet. Now, to back up just a bit, to think about the role of prophecy. We know about the Old Testament biblical prophets and so many other people who were called prophets. Miriam, you know, the sister of Moses, I don't think is called a, no, I'm sorry, she is called a prophet. I take it back. She's called a prophet, and she leads the Israelite women in a song of exultation. In traditional Middle Eastern societies, it is the role of women to sing a song of triumph in times of victory, a song of mourning in times of defeat and terrible situations, to give voice to the experience and the feelings of the people. And that's what Mary does in her song that we call the Magnificat. That is it's an echo of another Hannah in 1 Samuel, who is wanting a child and can't have a child, and then Samuel is born, and she bursts forth into a song very, very similar to Mary's. When Luke is composing his account of Mary in this situation, he is probably modeling her song on that of Hannah. So there are motifs that are the same, particularly the motif of God raises up the lowly and puts down the proud. This reversal, it's a social revolution. And we sometimes think of Mary's song as a nice prayer, but in fact, it's proclaiming a social revolution, that God sees the lowly, and those who are haughty, are proud, even those who have it off, well off in life, look out, because God is on the side of the oppressed and the poor, and that's what her song is proclaiming. So Mary in Luke's Gospel she's not called a prophet, but she certainly functions that way and is recognized that way. Later on, Jesus will be recognized as a prophet as well. A prophet is someone who speaks with the authority of God, someone who can proclaim to people what are God's interests, How does God really want all this done? You know, Elizabeth is the one who receives Mary's message. It is the encounter and the relationship of the two women to each other, with each other, and their unborn children that proclaims that God's promises are going to be kept. That's another important motif in Mary's song, is that God is about to keep God's promises, and that this coming wonderful thing that's going to happen will indeed fulfill all of God's promises to Israel, to God's people. The other woman is Anna, who, if you remember, is in the temple. She's a widow. She was widowed very early in life, and she's been devoting the rest of her life to coming to the temple every day and praying, and she is called a prophet. Simeon, just before her, is the one who has the canticle this time, the song. Now you can dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation. Again, it's the same theme of fulfilling the promises, fulfilling God's promises. And Anna, this time, doesn't have words, but she certainly does. It says that she tells everybody around what she sees here. And so the appearance of this child in the temple is the thing that provokes that reaction, you know, that response on the part of a number of people, and Anna is very much a part of that, and she's the prophet in the woman prophet in the temple. The other two other pieces to point out in Luke's gospel. First of all, in chapter 8, at the beginning of chapter 8 in Luke, you have a description of a number of women who are following Jesus along with the male disciples. The first one is Mary Magdalene, and we'll talk about her in the next segment. But there are two others there, and many others. So you have a mention there of women disciples moving around with Jesus very early in the gospel, in chapter 8. No other gospel gives you that piece of information. The other, we call the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptic gospels, say at the time of Jesus' death, crucifixion. Now, there were this group of women who had come with them from Galilee, but Mark and Matthew, don't mention it until the time of the Passion. Luke puts them right in here and says that there is this group of women disciples who are following Jesus along with the others. And so there's recognition earlier on in the gospel that they are there. The other unusual thing, it's only in Luke, the group of women that Jesus encounters on the way to the cross, and they're weeping over him. And he says, oh, don't weep over me, weep over yourselves, because the time is coming when, and it's a prediction of the catastrophe to come with the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. So Luke has a way of highlighting some women characters. And often it is said that Luke is the most favorable gospel toward women. I dispute that, because I think the women in the Gospel of John are so much more interesting. And in the first segment, I talk about this issue of agency. And you could look in both cases, in Luke and in John, and how women are exercising agency here. But let's take on the Samaritan woman in chapter 4. I say take her on because there's so much there and we can't possibly talk about it all. But here you have this anomaly of the Jesus and his disciples right there in the middle of Samaria, whereas we from other sources, we get the idea that Jews avoided Samaria. They didn't want to go directly through it. But there he is, right in the middle. And the unusual time of the day, it's the middle of the day when women don't go out to the well to get water. They do it at the cool times of the day, early morning and in the late afternoon. So you have an unnamed Samaritan woman. She never has a name. And she encounters Jesus, who's sitting there because it's the heat of the day and it's too hot to travel, and they're all sort of lying in the shade, waiting for the heat to go away. So you have the encounter of Jesus with this woman, and if you read it carefully, in each case, each step, I should say, in each step of the way, Jesus says something, she responds. He takes it a little further, and it's just step by step by step when he leads her into the point where she recognizes that he's the Messiah, and then turns around and says, leaves her water jar, forgets what she was there for, and runs into town and tells other people. So in John's Gospel, you don't have a scene in which Jesus assembles his male disciples and says, go out to the towns and do this and this and only take one purse and don't take an extra pair of sandals and da-da-da. You don't have any of that. You don't have any of these instructions for discipleship in John. What you have is his encounter with a Samaritan woman and his showing how to lead someone to faith. He models that. And then she turns around and spreads the word, and so she models discipleship, and she models apostleship. She models how in John's community they want the word to get out. Martha is also a very interesting character in John's Gospel, and this is in chapter 11 in the story of the raising of Lazarus. So you have Mary and Martha, these sisters of Lazarus, siblings, three siblings there. Lazarus has died. Jesus hesitates, waits to come. And I have always thought when I read that story that the actual raising of Lazarus, Lazarus coming out of the tomb, is not the point of the story. It's maybe the climax. It's the thing everybody's waiting for and happens, but what really is important is the conversation between Jesus and Martha and the way in which he leads Martha to a faith. With the Samaritan woman, it's the recognition that he's the Messiah. Here with Martha, it's the recognition that life is knowing Jesus, leading into this deeper understanding of what the resurrection is and who Jesus is, that this is really the point. And she finally comes to the acknowledgement that he is the one they've been waiting for, the one who is always coming into the world. And that phrase I think should always be in the present tense, because it is in the Greek, the one who is coming into the world, not the one who has come, the one who is coming, who is always coming, always arriving. So the Samaritan woman and Martha are models of faith, models of discipleship, and models of evangelization and of preaching the gospel, really, by their witness. The mother of Jesus is, of course, present at Cana. She's the one who precipitates Jesus' first sign, his first manifestation of his glory. She's unnamed. She's never named. And she's at the cross. And in fact, at the cross, she has a sister named Mary. So that's very puzzling. Is her name Mary, too? She simply does not have a name, like the Samaritan woman. They are types. They are they're symbols. They're images. They're the disciple who needs no name because Jesus is the one with the name. Jesus is the one to whom they go, and so they are in medieval drama, European medieval drama, there was a character called Everyman. who didn't have a name, who spoke the things that needed to be said, the interpretation of things going on. And in a way, the Samaritan woman and Mary function that way. Mary's there at the beginning to inaugurate this manifestation of glory, and she's there at the end when it is all accomplished. And the final character is Mary Magdalene, who is in all four Gospels, and we're going to talk about her more in the next segment. But particularly in John, I would single out the episode in chapter 20. She's the first one to the tomb. She sees that the tomb is empty. She doesn't understand. She runs back to tell the disciples. The beloved disciple, who is, of course, this mysterious character in the Gospel of John, goes and it says, he looked in, he saw, and he believed. So the beloved disciple is always the one who does the right thing, and that's another whole thing. But Mary was there first, but she didn't get it. The beloved disciple did. Then you have her back at the tomb, and you have the episode where Jesus calls her name, and she doesn't recognize him until he says her name. She thinks he's the gardener because this is a garden. And that raises the whole question of did the risen Jesus look like himself? Did everybody recognize him? Which seems like sometimes not, until there was some characteristic thing. Remember the story of the disciples in the end of Luke's Gospel at Emmaus, where they're walking with him the whole time, and they don't get it, that's who he is, until he breaks the bread, and then they recognize him. So that's another whole theme. But this encounter of Mary Magdalene with Jesus in the garden, knowing him once he says her name, she again is she's a principal character here. But we're going to talk about her next chapter, next segment. To just highlight also this question of there are women in Mark and Matthew. There's the Canaanite or Syrophoenician woman. I didn't talk about her. In Mark and Matthew, whose faith to have her child cured is the thing that provokes Jesus really to give her what she wants. Very perceptive and persistent woman. You have a persistent widow, of course, also in Luke. There are other characters. But I just wanted to also say something about the scene in Mark 3 and Matthew 12, in which the family of Jesus does not come out well, including his mother, where the Jesus has gone off and he's preaching in somebody's house, and the word comes to him that his mother and his brothers, his family, and that could be cousins, I mean that doesn't have to be literally brothers, but his family are out there looking for him. And instead of getting up and going out to greet them or saying, oh, invite them in, he says, who are my mother and my brothers? Those who hear the will of God, the word of God and keep it. These are my mother and brothers and sisters. And that scene, of course, is about the emphasis on discipleship. What does it really mean to be Jesus' disciple? Who is closest to Jesus? At the same time, the family of Jesus, including his mother, don't come off very well. And we have to balance that against the role of the mother of Jesus in the Gospel of John, in which she seems to be involved in his ministry at the beginning and the end. So, in other words, we have two different perspectives here on how the mother of Jesus and his family accepted him. In fact, in Mark 3, it says that they came to get him because they thought he was out of his mind. So in these early stages, you don't have a family or a mother who understand what is going on. Maybe you could say that later on she understood, but we have these differences of perspective. And finally, the question, how did Jesus treat women? Well, with respect. And again, here we have to be careful about anti-Jewish bias. Jesus did not deliver them from the law, from the oppression of the Jewish law. That's not it. But we certainly can say that Jesus always treated women with respect and understanding and compassion. And so I think that is also a very important point.